Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
And I'm Tosin Anofowakin.
This week, we're going to talk about the potential dangers of crowdsourcing a manhunt, a hacked tweet that cost economic markets billions of dollars, Twitter music, Windows brings back the start button, Netflix's winning strategy, and a couple of bills in the U.S. Congress you won't want to ignore. But first, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And I wanted to talk about the I saw over the weekend Zombieland the series, which I bring up because it's part of an initiative that Amazon Studios, which is the quote-unquote Hollywood division of the online shopping giant, what they've begun this initiative where they have 14 pilots available for viewing on Amazon Instant Video in order for subscribers to watch for free and rate and review them. And Zombieland, the series, which is based on the hit movie from a few years back, is one of the pilots. And I actually caught a couple of the different pilots, two or three pilots that were part of their offerings. I saw a pilot called Browsers. I'm sorry, no. It was called Betas, which is basically about Silicon Valley startups, and an animated comedy from the guys behind The Big Bang Theory. And I have to say that none of the pilots that I saw, even Zombieland, none of them felt like, you know, complete sure things. They all felt like they missed the mark just a little bit. It felt like I was watching. I hate to doom such an ambitious project, but it felt like I was watching failed pilots. You know,
interesting,
the kind of pilots that you would see that you know have failed, and you go, oh, okay, I see why that one failed, or I see this why.
So
this
kind one. Of like sci-fi, not to put sci-fi on the spot here, but some of their original series. Like that sort of quality?
Yeah. I think something along the line. Like Zombieland, the series, just never felt like it had the same sort of like personality or spark as the movie. And none of the actors compared to the original actors from the movie. Although they were playing the same characters. Just never felt like it gelled together as a series.
Yeah, I mean, that does seem like a difficult... at least as far as Zombieland goes, it seems like it's a difficult mechanism to have successful for a long-term show rather than this short glimpse that you had with the movie.
Yeah. I mean, all the same, I'm glad that they're doing this because it's a little different from Netflix's approach because Netflix, and we'll talk about that a little bit later in the show, but Netflix's approach is that they collect this data about their users and they use that data to create a show that hopefully matches the subscribers' likes or dislikes. And here, Amazon is throwing 14 pilots up on the wall, essentially, and getting data feedback from viewers as to which shows they plan to move forward with producing and which ones they are going to kill. And I think they've got a lot of kills in this pile. So maybe you know, this could be what they call in basketball, a rebuilding year, a building year, you know, team building year. Maybe next year's 14 pilots will do better than this year's.
Yeah, you know, it depends on how much money Amazon's really interested in putting in this direction. So I guess we'll see.
Yeah. In any case, these pilots are free for anyone, any Amazon Instant Video subscriber. So just go to your whatever channel you use to view Amazon Instant Video, and you can check those these pilots out. Now, Tosin, you have a little bit of exciting news about what you were playing with this week.
Yeah, so I lucked out yesterday and was able to head over to Google Campus and try out both Glass, as well as for a very short period of time, try out the Chromebook Pixel. Unfortunately, I will hold off on talking about Glass just this moment and concentrate a little bit on the Chromebook Pixel.
Tell us about the Pixel.
Just because it was such a short touch with it that there's not too much to say about it, so I might as well get that on the table here. It was really a short interaction. I kind of say I do like the look and design of it. It's kind of this sleek, it looks chrome-ish look of this unibody. And it's actually surprisingly light. It's a very – for a squarish design, it is surprisingly light and very cool to the touch. So I think they really built it effectively where I don't think you're going to really sense much overheating when you are trying to push it to its prime. So as far as a looker, it looked pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
The only issue, of course, is the cost versus the functionality that you're getting from it. And so that's going to be a different story. I was just doing more like light web browsing and light functionality, but nothing heavier. And, you know, of course, as you guys are aware of the restrictions that come with the Chromebook Pixel in terms of applications that you can run. So,
yeah,
but other than that, it looked pretty cool.
We've talked about this on the show. We've talked about the sort of the use case scenario for the Chromebook Pixel and who would be able to justify the cost versus the sort of lack of functionality of the device. And I think we kind of came up that this was perfect for like the office manager who needs to justify having an expensive unit, yet one that they're not necessarily going to be using to push a lot of pixels.
Yeah, which is kind of funny, but especially due to the high resolution. Still, it's really hard to justify based off the price, but who knows? You know, maybe that point will drop in the future. I had a small touch on that. And I think what everyone is more excited about is, yes, I did get to try out Glass. I went there with a friend who was actually picking up Glass. What Google does for the founders is they are allowed to come to Google, bring over a friend, and they kind of sit you down and have a one-on-one session on how to use the device.
Mm-hmm.
They walk you around through different sort of tests that you can run with it and just giving you advice and just having a frank discussion around it. And then they also give you your set of Glass as well as a bunch of accessories.
So did you actually get yourself a unit to take home? Did you actually purchase a Glass unit or just try it out?
So unfortunately, you can't purchase a unit at that point. Now, my friend had signed up for it, and he actually ended up winning a competition. So his unit, which he was going to purchase, ended up getting for free. But at that point, he actually got to take it home with him. And so now he has a Glass unit, which is kind of interesting. While he was driving in the car, I was also trying it out too. So it made for a pretty unique experience. So I think there's a lot of things I can say about Glass and kind of my thoughts behind it. So I think the first thing I'll start off is aesthetics.
Sure.
They had a range of, I believe it was 5 different colors, from black, white, light blue, red, as well as like a brown / chrome look. So one of the things which I never really noticed is when you're looking at Glass head on, it looks very slick, very slim. I didn't realize how the main portion that controls like the UI is definitely a bit thicker. in terms of size. So uh-huh. that was kind of one of the things that shocked me a little, because you never really notice that aspect of glass, since you're always looking at it head from like a forward perspective.
Sure. But they gotta have some place to put all the all the electronics, and then there's like a counterweight, isn't there?
Exactly. The electronics, the jawbone receiver, all of that stuff has to be placed somewhere. So it makes sense as far as the device is concerned. It's just something that I wasn't completely expecting or even really considering, which is kind of interesting to think as a techie person. I had missed that portion. The frame itself is really flexible. Mm-hmm. So, and it makes sense that it's really flexible, because that's how you make sure it fits appropriately for the different people who want to wear it. So you can bend it quite a bit to, you know, stretch it out for larger heads, or bend the nose pads to mm-hmm. adjust where it sits on your nose. And the other really interesting thing for me, and I know a lot of people have said this already, is the screen when you're wearing glass is just a bit above your line of sight. So you're actually really looking up to examine what you need to see the information that glass is displaying, rather than looking directly straight forward, which takes a little bit of getting used to. And that was one of the things which I could actually think about in terms of driving. It seems like glass could, in fact, be very dangerous if you are not very careful when you are driving. I was the one who was trying it in the car, and I was in the passenger seat, uh-huh. but I could clearly see how it was quite a distraction when I was taking a slight peek up rather than looking at the road. And it was actually a very interesting question when we brought it up. You know, hey, can you do you guys use it to drive? And, mm-hmm. of course, the Google employees gave all these safety precautions. Right. And didn't necessarily say no, but also didn't say yes. And that is actually going to be a real interesting thing that we're going to notice as time elapses. You know, what's the legal precedent for right. something like this? Because right. to tell you the truth, it's really as dangerous as texting if you're not careful.
I would imagine that this would probably fairly quickly fall under the same sort of distracted driving laws as texting or anything else that you're doing while you're driving.
Right.
I'm willing to bet that like maybe this is the kind of thing where you, as the driver yourself, there'll be some sort of laws enacted where you cannot be wearing this while you're driving. Like if you're navigating, if you're using GPS, that you'd have to give it to someone sitting in the passenger seat, but not wear it yourself. Like I can see where this would be okay to wear while you're walking, fine, you know, and you still have to take care crossing the street. But driving, I'll bet you anything that this quickly falls into the same sort of guidelines for distracted driving.
So now, as far as the device itself, I know the big question that Dwayne probably has here is this ready for me to pick up? Is this consumer grade gadget? And I don't think it's there yet. I think it is, and I think Google also realizes that as well too. I think it's very niche right now in terms of its functionality. Mm-hmm. So one thing you're gonna notice is that glass, at least currently, is really limited to the Google ecosystem. So, for example, posting a photo. If I wanted to post a photo, there are only two places where I could post a photo currently. One would be Google Plus, which makes sense. Mm-hmm. But the other is I want to say Plan. There's that Path, that social network called Path.
Oh, sure, sure.
Right. You cannot easily post to Facebook. As far as I know, you cannot easily send a tweet either. It does store some information on the device, and you can currently have, I believe it was 10 contacts stored on the device itself. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to interact with them. So It is really limited right now in terms of what you can do with the device. There was actually a point when I was wearing the device where I suddenly started to think to myself, well, now what? I couldn't think of anything that I actually wanted to do while I had glass on me. And this is after leaving Google Campus and just hanging out with my friend. So I think as far as like the pricing point versus the current functionality, really it's kind of a prototype to show you what is possible, what direction that they see going. And I think that part is really promising. I think down the road, you know, after they gain more functionality in the device, and potentially this is, you know, when they bring on more API partners, I think it could be really cool. Assuming that Google, you know, doesn't limit themselves, doesn't make this a closed system and continues that same Android focus of having it an open system where other mm-hmm. people can build applications for, as well as where you get the key applications and making things easy, making life easy for people. I will say some of the cool applications that we tried out on the device were Hangout. I had a Hangout, Google Hangout with a friend, which is really cool because and it was actually really funny because he started the Hangout and I was somewhere else on campus using my mobile device, so he could see whatever I was showing, and I could see what he was directing with glass. So that was pretty very unique, making phone calls. And something which I tried while I was in the car was directions. The direction overlay is really sleek, especially when you start looking at walking directions. That was really cool. So I definitely think there's a lot of promise. And I think the direction which you're heading with that is going to be really cool in the future. I just think if you're talking about today, right now, you know, it's not something worth the cost for just a common interested consumer. It's just not that consumer grade ready yet.
Well, I'm sure. I'm sure Dwayne would be gleefully happy to hear that.
I mean, there are a lot of other really unique things, which I'm sure I'll get in discussions with you. Like, I will say the Jawbone.
The bone conduction speaker.
That worked really well. It was the audio which I was getting from the device, very crystal clear. And also it's kind of really cool to you really can hear the audio coming from that device and it's not distracting with all the other noise around you in the environment. So that was super impressive.
Wow. Good on them. I that would be great if that technology were to be extended to other, devices as well. Like that, I wouldn't mind wearing a bone conduction, earpiece for, answering phones, like a Jawbone type of thing. But yeah, that sounds great. And Google recently, emphasized that their terms of service has a clause that threatens to deactivate the device should you transfer, resell, or loan it out to a friend without their explicit authorization. I think that was because people were starting to sell them on eBay for this, exorbitant profits, or people would be tweeting or posting that they would loan their glass unit out to friends, and so there was some sort of clear sort of violations of their terms of service. So I'm glad that you had authorization to try out the device.
Oh yeah, no, it was. I tried it out for a short period. Heard a lot of discussion about it from their employees, who also, see some of the issues and are really waiting to get more feedback on the device and move forward with it. And it was good to see that they're open about it and they don't feel as though it's, closed in terms of where the device is heading. But also, actually, one thing which I think might be interesting to bring up is one of the concepts that they really tried to push is, as a founding member, so this is more directed to people who actually have glass now.
Sure.
They get to define public treatment of the device and what is acceptable and what is not acceptable in with the device. So they really get to be the groundbreaking individuals who kind of could decide, you know, national policy, so to speak. For example, one of the Google employees said whenever he's on like the train, on the Caltrain around here, that he, you know, people of course would be always curious if you're recording. He just wears glass around his neck or puts it on the top of his head, and that's kind of a clear distinction that, hey, I'm not recording you. I'm not taking photos. It's a clear distinction that, you know, this is not – nothing's going on. And I think it gives people some sort of sense of security in those circumstances too. So these – whoever has glass, these founding members get to decide how we treat glass.
Yeah, I think that's –
for better or for worse.
Right. They're setting this sort of – the social contract, the rules governing its use in public.
Yeah, and the touch on the device is actually pretty impressive, I would say. I mean, we've seen a lot of touch before, but it felt very smooth in terms of navigating the menus and, you know, telling Google Glass what to do. It took me a little bit to get used to looking up to just start Glass to turn it on. But no, pretty cool, and I think what I'm sort of excited about is maybe messing around with their APIs.
I can't wait to hear more about that. I cannot wait for this to come down to a price where it's, you know, affordable for everybody, and then we really start to see some sort of, once people get it in, a lot of people get it in their hands and they start playing around with it and stretching what it can do. And stretching it beyond its sort of, you know, its intended usage, and we really get to sort of play around with it and do some homebrew stuff. That's when it's going to get really exciting.
Right. Right.
All right. Let's get into some of our headlines here. We would be remiss if we didn't mention the events surrounding the tragic April 15th bombing of the Boston Marathon, which claimed 3 lives and injured hundreds more. The subsequent manhunt for the perpetrators launched a legion of armchair warriors and citizen journalists who rallied together with certainly good intent, but not all of their efforts turned out to be beneficial. Case in point, community news sharing site Reddit, whose users dedicated several hours during the incident to compile information into several minute-by-minute updates to the event. Some of the comment threads within those updates spawned their own theories about who the bombers were and how best to deal with them. Reddit's community manager, Eric Martin, took to the company's blog to admit its part in spreading misinformation and offered an apology for the unintended consequences. He said, however, though started with noble intentions, some of the activity on Reddit fueled online witch hunts and dangerous speculation, which spiraled into very negative consequences for innocent parties. The Reddit staff and millions of people on Reddit around the world deeply regret that this happened. While on-the-ground Reddit reporting isn't the kind of information typically posted on Reddit, it shows yet again the power and danger of the Internet's wide-open publishing capabilities. Information may want to be free, but there's often a cost associated with unverified facts that are widely distributed at rapid speed. What did you think of the situation involving sort of the crowdsourcing of the manhunt on in the wake of the bombings?
Yeah, you know what? It's really unfortunate that the power of misinformation, because not only did it, you know, affect the lives of many innocent people who weren't related, but I think the far-reaching thing we saw in it was when major news networks who,
like CNN, for example,
exactly, who we as a public nation deem trustable. So, you know, the internet, even including Wikipedia, is not trusted resources that you use when you write a paper. But often news sites, to a certain extent, can be, or at least in the past, were deemed as potentially trusted sources of information. when they start, you know, also spreading the misinformation, either from what they've heard on Reddit, you know, that's where you have this huge, huge issue. And you know what? I'm not sure what we can do in the future to stop mm-hmm. things of this nature, because there's always going to be the couch detective, because
right.
it's very easy to plunge into that or in any sort of realm and try and solve cases. I mean, we've seen examples where some Reddit individuals have been able to correctly resolve issues, mm-hmm. Potentially issues revolving around, you know, hey, where was this photo taken? Or, you know, tell me a little bit more about this information, rather than being things that really threaten the lives of others. So I think it's a societal issue, and I don't see it going away anytime soon. It's going to be really interesting to see what sort of precautions Reddit and other sources take to try and impede this. And is it even going to be possible to impede this? You know, once you have this open channel of communication, where, you know, to a certain extent, people within the Reddit community trust Reddit to allow them free speech, but in the same part, you're also potentially causing harm to others. I don't know. What are your thoughts here?
Well, I would hope that I don't know that this is the case, but I would hope that with every situation like this, that the community does a little bit of course correction and learns from their mistakes. And I mean, if they're serious about, like, another related news story is that Anonymous wants to start their own news service. And you've got this sort of swell of crowdsourcing sites that want to get into citizen journalism. And I feel like in order to do that, you have to have a sense of responsibility. You have to maintain a sense of responsibility. And I would hope that in a situation like this, after a situation like this, that the community would course correct and work out ways so that incidents like that don't happen again. And it's one thing. It's always a tough balance between wanting to be the first one with the information that you believe is correct, and verifying that information is correct, you know, putting out accurate information. And that's why the big news services aren't as quick as like Twitter or Reddit or even, you know, Facebook, other sites like that. It's because they basically, the big news services wait, and they have a protocol that they have to stick to as far as getting out accurate information. And so they get out sometimes you get into a situation like with CNN where you'll disseminate disinformation because you haven't checked it out very, very thoroughly, and then you get your the whole foot and mouth situation that happened with CNN. And I think with Reddit or 4chan or Anonymous, I mean, they just throw stuff up there, and they don't have the infrastructure to accurately verify this stuff at the same level as the professional news gathering sites.
Yeah, well, the professional ones are ones we question nowadays too.
Yes,
ever since, you know, the election, back with Bush versus Gore, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I wonder if, you know, at some point it sort of feels like it's getting worse, and who knows where that, you know, hopefully this was the breaking point, which allows everyone to realign themselves and refocus correctly.
I think it's always going to be, it's always going to be a battle between fast and accurate, and there are always going to be casualties, along the way, between those two extremes. Speaking of respected news sources spreading disinformation, AP, the official Twitter handle of the respected Associated Press news agency, sent out a message at about 1 o'clock on Tuesday this week saying, breaking, two explosions in the White House and Barack Obama is injured. The AP quickly said that this was a hacked tweet, and White House Press Secretary Jay Carney said the president is fine despite what the hacked Twitter feed said. However, the market impact was already intense. The Dow plunged more than 140 points and bond yields fell. Within 6 minutes, the Dow recovered its losses and was trading with triple-digit gains. But in a closely linked trade, the dollar and yen also plunged temporarily to 98.60 before recovering to a level above 99. The false tweet comes at a time of hypersensitivity in the markets toward terrorism following the Boston Marathon bombings. It also highlights the vulnerability of social media and follows on the hacking of other media sites. A group calling itself the Syrian Electronic Army, which is supportive of Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad, later claimed that it was responsible for the tweet on its own Twitter account. The group has also claimed to have hacked the Twitter accounts of National Public Radio, the BBC, and 60 Minutes. I saw this and I was a little stunned, because this to me is more than sort of, I think more than any other example that I've seen previously, this is a clear-cut example of cyber terrorism at work and how like a hacked Twitter account can contribute to the destabilization of a country by an enemy foreign state. And I may sound like I'm being overly dramatic here, but the losses involved in this tweet were $136.5 billion. I think that's pretty staggering. And, you know, the market recovered, but it was only, who knows what the impact of another hacked tweet like this could be, if it's not, especially one that's not caught in time, or one where the misinformation is spread by other major news sources, like we talked about with CNN and the Boston bombing.
Yeah, it's. I think there are several aspects to this news story. One thing is online security, and you know, it's one thing to say, "Hey, be secure online." It's another thing to really practice it. But I think a third factor is really the organizations that the utilities that you are leveraging online should do more to allow you to protect yourself. So, for example, I know there's been a lot of discussion on, you know, Twitter is now testing two-factor authentication. Well, really, this should have been done a while ago, because after Twitter has been hacked a few times, or at least there was a recent account dump that occurred with, I think their passwords were encrypted, but, or at least were salted. But still, it's at that point where you realize that, hey, I'm a sort of national entity. A lot of people use me as a trusted resource. We need to make sure that our users out there are protected, and that are, and at least have the mechanisms in place so that people can go ahead and make sure that they're more secure. Now, that's not to say that this will solve all the issues, right? Mm-hmm. But I think it does a little bit more to stem some of them. And then there's also that debate about it, in the world which we live in, it's very cool to see that everything is tied and interconnected and adjustable that way. But you also need those checks and balances along the way just to be careful for situations like this. 'Cause it didn't seem like this was something which was done. It didn't seem like this failure was a failure on a individual level where people within the DAO were panicking and trading. It seemed like it was an automated thing where they had systems in place which would automatically, you know, sell or you know, sell shares, and those are what kicked in because of the calculations. And it actually makes you really think, you know, this is, although this was something which was directly inverted by a tweet, by something that came that was released by an individual. There, mm-hmm. we've seen a lot more cases where, you know, a mathematical error can lead to destruction. We actually had one of our engineers, David Meaner, at Box, gave a talk today for our customer success team about, you know, his experiences. As he's worked in all sorts of positions, Lockheed, EA, and has been around the industry and seen a lot of the technological developments. But he discussed of a situation where, you know, there was a the situation where there was basically, I think it was a French or a European launch that was supposed to carry a lot of satellites up to space, and because of a slight miscalculation or a slight misobservation, I think that's what I'd call it, because of a, you know, not thinking that the speeds for a program would exceed a certain digit range, caused the entire thing to blow up in air because it thought it was, you know, heading straight for the ground, so it automatically self-destructed, losing millions of dollars, right?
Holy smokes.
And that was actually due to people just saying, hey, this software worked for this earlier model, let's just toss it into this later model. You know, things like that where we don't think critically enough about what we're doing in the long-term implications. We look at the short-term focus, mm-hmm. and I think the short-term focus maybe for this was, hey, we get all the data and we can be agile and very quick, but we didn't. But there's no long-term perception of, well, really, is what's being said on Twitter, should that really be considered a trusted location when it comes to trading and when it comes to making adjustments?
Also, isn't that how Bain tried to destabilize Gotham City?
That is true, actually. That is very true, except he did it a more direct route.
Yeah. All right. Moving on here. After months of rumors, Twitter publicly launched its music service for iPhone and the web last week, and you no longer have to be among the rich and famous to play around with it. Twitter Music is a simple visual way to explore songs and artists who your friends are listening to and who you may not know about just by signing in to an existing Twitter account. The app and website are broken down into four sections: popular, emerging, suggested, and now playing. Each section displays a grid of album art and band logos that individually expand when you tap or click on them, letting you quickly follow or listen to an artist. By default, music will play short iTunes previews. If you have a Spotify or RDO account, the app can play full tracks instead. For those interested in discovering new artists, Twitter Music is at its strongest in suggested and now playing sections. The former is able to analyze the tastes of even the least prolific of tweeters, resulting in a charming curation of artists that you like and artists that you've never heard of, without you having to enter any preferences into the app. Its suggestions can be pretty good, but like any recommendation, it can be a little off the mark. I played around with this over the last week, and I have to say that I played around with it when it first came online. I found that the popular rank of the artists were incredibly sort of inaccurate. Like, I think Linkin Park was in the top five, and I can't remember Linkin Park being popular. You know,
I had one of their CDs.
And how long ago was that, right?
Yeah.
So, but after about a week or so, I think it's sort of like leveled off, and it seems to be a little bit more accurate now. I tried connecting this to my Spotify account, and I found that it wasn't nearly it, like I wasn't getting a connection through to it. Wouldn't play from my Spotify account like as advertised, and even on a couple of different browsers. So I think maybe an issue on my end, but it wasn't a clear cut sort of slam dunk on connecting that. So I just used it with the iTunes previews. It seemed to be fine. I'm a little.
So now, does it only allow you to, like, does it allow you to have some sort of like auto queuing system where you could create a playlist, or does it only give you like the short segment of a song unless you connect with
it gives
Spotify?
You, unless you connect with Spotify, it only gives you the iTunes preview, which is like a minute and a half. And if you allow it to go that route, it will just keep playing the next song in the queue of what's popular or emerging, whatever tab of the site that you're on. You click on one song, and it'll go immediately to the next one after that, and just keep playing through to the end of the queue. So, have you had a chance to check this out? I'm assuming no.
No, I have not. It just, I don't know. It when they first, when we at least secretly heard that they were working on a music project, I thought it would be something which is meant to maybe challenge Spotify or be different. And now it just seems like a kind of pet project. It doesn't seem anything that holds as much weight. I mean, maybe if you can get people to start talking more about what they're listening, but if you're only giving me a short clip of a song, well, I'm not that interested to go through your service. I'd rather just find or discover that through Spotify itself. I don't see where exactly this fits into the market unless mm-hmm. the titles that they are really helping discover are more indie and less mainstream. And from all what I heard, it sounds like it's more primarily mainstream verified Twitter accounts.
I'm still hoping to see some sort of use case scenario with this emerge. Like, I'm hoping that maybe we'll start to see the usage of it form once sort of there will be a killer app usage of this as some celebrities start to tweet something or some musicians start to tweet things. I think we've yet to see exactly sort of the perfect scenario for this service.
Yeah, I would agree there too. I don't see the use case yet. I mean, maybe it will uncover itself, but mm-hmm. so far it's not something that holds my interest, at least as a fan of music or as a musician.
Okay, moving on here. Sources familiar with Microsoft's plans have revealed to The Verge that Windows 8.1 will include the return of the Start button. The button will act as a method to simply access the Start screen and not include the traditional Start menu. The button is said to look near identical to the existing Windows flag used in the charm bar. Microsoft's change of heart follows another recent plan change for Windows 8.1, a boot to desktop option. Microsoft will add an option to allow users to boot directly to the traditional desktop environment in future builds of the upcoming Windows 8 upgrade. The death of the traditional Start button in Windows 8 was one of a number of controversial changes included with Microsoft's latest operating system. 1.5 million downloads of Pokey, a Start menu replacement, and other similar tools suggest that Windows 8 users still want the Start button and the Start menu. So do you think that this indicates a failure of the Metro system for Windows?
It's really hard to say, because on one hand, it's like, oh, Windows, Microsoft is listening to people, so they're going ahead and making changes. But it's also kind of a failure to their UI developers, because I thought Microsoft really wanted to make an ecosystem change and a differential and basically just stick to their guns and say, you guys will, I can't please everyone. You guys will get used to it. I guess what we'll really see is, although the button, it seems like it's halfway in between, because although the button is coming back, it looks mm-hmm. like it's actually more along the lines to jump you back to the tiles. Is that what I'm hearing it?
No, well, I think what will happen is you'll have the option to boot to the desktop. The button, if you hit the button, I think it'll take you to the Metro interface, and I think that's the way that'll work from what I understand. Yeah, so you won't get that traditional Start menu. You still have to access that through the Finder level somehow. I've used Windows 8.1, but I've used Windows 8, but I'm not a prolific user of Windows 8. I'm still not entirely sure how I don't flow very well between Metro and the desktop version. You know, I if it was up to me, I'd want to stay in the desktop version all the time. I think I thought about this last week too when I heard about this news. I think the perfect scenario would be to market to publish Windows 8 as one OS, but market it in two different flavors. It's going to be the exact same OS under the desktop, but if you install it on a tablet, it will boot up in Metro, and if you install it on a desktop, it'll boot up in the desktop mode. And you can still switch between those modes as easily as you want. It will just appear in one mode or the other depending on the device that you load it on. But it's exactly the same OS under the hood. That way, people who get it on a tablet will expect to see the Metro interface, and that's what they'll get. And when you get it on a desktop or on a laptop, you'll expect to see the desktop option, and that's what you'll get there. I don't know. What do you think? That's a crazy idea?
That could work, but you know, for me, actually, so I've been using Windows 8 as my primary desktop.
Really?
That's what I'm actually on right now. What I really wish they would fix is this dual screen dynamic, because clearly it wasn't built for dual screens. Mm. What actually happens is if you are in the Metro view, mm-hmm. it appears on one screen, your primary screen, but your secondary screen will be whatever you previously had. So usually I'll have some sort of application running, like maybe IRC. Mm-hmm. And if I click on that other screen, then my Metro disappears on my primary screen and becomes the desktop mode. So most of the time I spend it in desktop mode. Really, Metro only comes when I need to navigate to applications. And so what I've done is I started making more shortcuts for things which I need as tiles. So I just go to the bottom corner, click, and then click on, you know, say, for example, Skype. Mm-hmm. So in that regard, I've gotten relatively good about it in terms of navigating. So I guess it really depends what sort of options how much flexibility they allow you to have with the start button. And for me, you know, I really wish that there are two wishes here. Either make the start button really flexible, so it's like the old version of Windows, because that's a majority of where my time is spent on this traditional landscape, where I can hit the application where I can, you know, I see the applications I'm running, and the Metro interface is only used as like a container to quickly navigate to something else, or make Metro more versatile where it actually works across more than one monitor, because come on, guys, like nowadays, many, many people have multiple monitors, and if you can't make the experience a powerful one across both, well, then there's no reason for me to really use it.
It seems like a dumb moment, like a missed opportunity that they didn't sort of engineer it to work intuitively across multiple monitors.
Yeah, well, you know what? They were probably – with Metro, it sounds like – a majority of the focus was more the mobile / you know, iPhone, iPad, tablet, Android tablet infrastructure, where you only have this one device, and that's where Metro seems to work best on touchscreen environments. But you also have to remember that a majority of your consumers are business or programmers who, you know, have a desktop environment. They really what they probably should have done is kind of that separation which you had, an OS for a mobile landscape as well as one for, you know, the desktop environment. I know everyone is trying to meld them closer and closer together.
Yeah.
Say Apple, and I can see why Microsoft wanted to do it, but hey, if you're not going to do it correct the first time, then you shouldn't do it at all, because then you start doing what you're going in the route that you are right now, where you are constantly unraveling the changes you made.
Well, I hope that Microsoft gets its act together, because as much as I love the Apple OS environment, and I have over the last few years migrated entirely to OS, I would hate to live in a world where that was the only choice, where, you know, there was no real competition. So for the sake of having competition and the innovation that competition spurs, I hope Microsoft gets their act together. Let's take a moment here to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'm recommending this week is Shatner Rules, Your Key to Understanding the Shatnerverse and the World at Large by William Shatner and Chris Regan. You love William Shatner. You admire his many and varied talents. You wish you could hang out with him. Admit it, you want to be William Shatner. And now you can, almost. This collection of rules, illustrated with stories from Bill's illustrious life and career, will show you how Bill became William Shatner, larger than life and bigger than any role he ever played. Shatner Rules is your guide to becoming William Shatner, or more accurately, beautifully Shatner-esque. Because let's face it, Shatner does rule, doesn't he? And the best part about this audiobook is, of course, it's narrated by William Shatner. So you get the full ham and cheese flowing through your headphones from this audiobook. And this audiobook, or any of Audible's other 100,000 plus titles, can be yours for free. All you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. That's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook. And even if you don't like the service, the 30-day trial, you quit the 30-day trial, you can keep that book for free. So once again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook. And it subscribing to Audible through that trial helps our show out. So please feel free to do so. We're going to take a little break here and listen to some music. And when we return, Netflix beats the market and a couple of bills in Congress that'll affect the way you shop and surf the net. So take a listen to this and come on back.
I have saved the world in the movies. So naturally, there's folks who think I must know what to do. But just because you've seen me on your TV doesn't mean I'm any more enlightened than you.
And while there's a part of me and that guy you've seen up there on that screen, I am so much more. And I wish I knew the things you think I do. I would change this world for sure. But I eat and sleep and breathe and bleed and feel. Sorry to disappoint you, but I'm real.
I'd love to help the world and all its problems, but I'm an entertainer, and that's all. So the next time there's an asteroid or a natural disaster, I'm flattered that you thought of me, but I'm not the one to call.
And while there's a part of me and that guy you've seen up there on that screen, I am so much more. And I wish I knew the things you think I do. I would change this world for sure. But I eat and sleep and breathe and bleed and feel. Sorry to disappoint you, but I'm real.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Tosin Onufuwakin. So Netflix's numbers are up and they're what Wall Street wanted for now. Shares are up 19%. Revenue came in at the $1 billion mark that analysts were looking for, and the company's U.S. streaming subscriber total hit 29.2 million paid subscribers in the U.S. for the first quarter, surpassing the 28.7 million subscribers HBO had racked up by the end of the year. This is a significant milestone considering HBO is the number two premium channel in the country after Encore, and that Netflix isn't even on cable to begin with. So, as predicted, Reed Hastings, CEO Reed Hastings, doesn't offer any real numbers for House of Cards, the company's much-hyped foray into original productions, but he does take credit for building big buzz with House of Cards via its decision to release all 13 episodes at once. If Netflix had followed a standard release schedule, you'd be watching the last episode of the series this week, and presumably more people you know would be talking about the show right now. But Hastings said the Big Bang worked just fine. It ended up, quote, reinforcing our brand attribute of giving consumers complete control over how and when they enjoy their entertainment. And certainly the market couldn't argue with that. Hastings also said that almost no one signed up for a free month-long trial to watch the show and then left Netflix afterwards. He said there was very little free trial gaming. Less than 8,000 people did this out of millions of free trials in the quarter. So I remember that was another thing that Dwayne had mentioned might be a concern. And the other news here is that Netflix will offer a family pricing plan for people who want to run multiple Netflix streams at the same time. A few members with large families run into our two simultaneous stream limit, Hastings said. To best serve these members, we're shortly adding a four stream plan at $11.99 in the U.S., and we're expecting fewer than 1% of our members to take it. So overall, a rousing success for Game House of Cards and for Netflix. And I think they're on a steady rise. And obviously they've surpassed HBO this quarter, so that this really means something for how people choose to consume online streaming video.
Yeah, you know what's actually really it's really interesting how Netflix has really found their niche, found their model in terms of, you know, how they want to attract subscribers, and really it's that sort of, hey, we've got this low price for you. You can now watch anything whenever you want to watch it. It's not that same sort of subsidized TV mechanism mm-hmm. where you know, for you to get extra stations, get extra things, you have to pony up more money and you don't really get to choose what you get in certain realms. I actually had a discussion with a friend who works at Netflix not too long ago. You know, what if Netflix, has Netflix considered, or what if they started doing sort of subsidies where, hey, if you also want, for example, HBO, although this would never happen, but if you also want HBO, how about you pay us, you know, several more dollars more to get that sort of content?
Right.
But his opinion, and, you know, just his opinion, was that, you know, that takes away from how Netflix – the foundations of what Netflix speaks to in terms of their principle of, you know, here, this is what users want and we give it to them. We don't start adding additional fees for what right. they'd like to view. And he thinks, you know, there's a limited space in which you'd see that improvement, and that, you know, by moving away from your core ideals, you really change how others perceive of you and how others will interact with your company in terms of when you're trying to gain new media. So I think it's good work there by Hastings. If you recall, I keep bringing this up, but he was almost tossed to the curb not too long ago. And huzzah, now they're celebrating more money, more people who are interested. Very cool to see that they're trying new series and new things, although I've heard some missteps about some of Hemlock Grove, but hey, people are at least tuning in and checking it out, and giving their own content its own light. So I only see more positives for Netflix, assuming they continue along the same trajectory and they don't change from what their foundations say they are.
It's It's fascinating to me that how drastically an internet startups fortunes can turn in a quarter or two. And I remember seeing the same sort of drastic turn of fate with both Amazon and Facebook. Both of those companies at one point were seriously doubting their futures, and even the companies themselves were taking great risks to try and, you know, basically keep themselves afloat. And they just basically the longevity, waiting for the users to sort of catch up with the what the purpose of the site, you know, waiting for the users. They had this great sort of all of those companies, Netflix, Facebook, and Amazon, had this sort of great like manifesto for their sites, and they were ahead of the curve, and all it took was just holding out a little bit longer for their users for people to kind of see their vision, is what I'm trying to say. Yeah, to see their vision. And I think Netflix has just held out long enough for people to finally see their vision of the usability of the site and support it.
Definitely agree. And like you said, startups come and go very quickly, and their fortunes do change at a whim. But hey, I enjoyed Netflix. I love having it as part of my my repertoire. Although I've been sick of late, you know, what I've been doing is I've been on my couch and watching Netflix. Actually, watching a MacGyver DVD I had sent to me from Netflix. So, classic TV on future technology.
That's very ironic, because just before we started the show, my wife was showing my daughter MacGyver for the first time.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, to show her the concept of the, you know, introducing her to the whole concept of MacGyver and how MacGyver as a character has affected popular culture.
Oh, Richard Dean Anderson has changed the world for the better.
Okay, so moving on, last couple of stories here are probably the most hardest hitting, the ones that will affect regular consumers and users of the internet the hardest, and they involve a couple of bills in Congress currently. And the first one is a controversial cybersecurity bill known as CISPA. It's once again in the news. The House approved the bill last week, and now it moves on to the Senate. But opponents of the measure are not going down without a fight. But what is CISPA, and why is it creating such a ruckus? Why is it being compared to SOPA and PIPA? Let's break it down. CISPA stands for Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, and it would allow for a voluntary information between sharing between private companies and the government in the event of a cyber attack. If the government detects a cyber attack that might take down Facebook or Google, for example, they could notify those companies. At the same time, Facebook or Google could inform the feds if they notice unusual activities on their networks that might suggest a cyber attack. Now, backers argue that CISPA is necessary to protect the U.S. against cyber attacks from countries like China and Iran, but opponents say that it would allow companies to easily hand over users' private information to the government thanks to a liability clause. According to the Electronic Frontier Foundation, essentially means that CISPA would override the relevant provisions in all other laws, including privacy laws. According to EFF, CISPA is written broadly enough to permit your communications service providers to share your emails and text messages with the government, or with your cloud storage company could share your stored files. Bill sponsors, however, argue that CISPA is needed to keep that data safe, pointing to foreign hackers who have hit U.S. companies in an effort to steal information. With SOPA and PIPA, tech firms were concerned about having their websites taken offline for no reason, which could have cost them millions of dollars. So there was a big incentive to see it defeated. CISPA, however, goes after cyber attacks, which also cost those firms money. If there's a way to get a heads up about a cyber attack, those companies are probably going to take it. The backlash against CISPA from the privacy consumer groups means the support for CISPA is somewhat muted, but there's some pretty big names on the bill's lists of supporters, including AT&T, Comcast, HP, IBM, Intel, Time Warner Cable, and Verizon. So it feels like CISPA, I can certainly see the EFF side of the situation where in the event of certain situations which could be sort of misinterpreted or deliberately loose interpretation of CISPA, our private information could be handed over to governments in the event of a cyber attack, whether it is, and also I think it has to do with the definition of a cyber attack in that case is fairly loose as well. And I can also see where this doesn't hit the pocketbooks of companies as hard as SOPA and PIPA, so they're less likely to want to stand behind it.
Yeah. Yeah. I've actually heard some interesting rumors, and take this as you may, around IBM being a backer of this because of certain technologies that they've been researching, Watson, and how it could come into play in such aspects. But those are only rumors. I think it's really critical with whatever sort of legislation that we pass in general, that it's very precise in its wording so that interpretation isn't too loose and broad. That's really the key. That it's very precise so that we can interpret it with those precise within that precise language. And we can build our opinions and correct it, because I think that's one of the issues you have with a lot of bills nowadays, that they're so loose. And maybe it's you know what? Now that I think about it, maybe it's because we are only looking at the short game and never looking down in the future. Say, hey, if I create this bill 50 years from now, when someone who wasn't a part of this process looks at this, will they be able to effectively interpret it and properly utilize it? I wonder if we ask those pointed questions, or if it's more along the lines of how can we solve problems that we have now?
I think that bill authors deliberately want to keep the language of the bill vague and undefined in order to be able to loosely interpret it. I mean, I think that's definitely intentional, and that's something that we all have to be. I think that's something that we have to be vigilant about, is about nailing our legislators to the wall about getting a more precise language or vetoing the bill outright.
Yeah, I didn't someone say loose words sink ships?
Yeah, something like that, for sure. But that's not the only bill in Congress right now that will affect people, particularly consumers. This week, the Senate is considering a bill that would give the states the ability to require large internet retailers like Amazon to collect sales taxes on all purchases and send the revenue to the appropriate locality. The bill could raise as much as $11 billion in uncollected taxes. It's called the Marketplace Fairness Act, and it would allow states and local governments to require large internet retailers and other remote sellers with sales over $1 million annually to collect sales taxes and send that revenue to the appropriate location. The arguments for the bill are the bill would flatten the playing field between online retailers and local stores. It would allow states to recoup a few billion dollars in taxes that are currently owed and go uncollected, and it would make tax collection slightly more progressive since poorer Americans are less likely to shop online. However, the objections against the bill are that many people complain that online retailers would have to face the hassle of collecting taxes, For the first time, online merchants would be forced to collect sales taxes for all of America's estimated 9,600 state and local taxing authorities. Another argument is that it favors larger companies like Walmart that can more easily collect taxes online and squeeze out smaller competitors. In response, some online retailers have asked that the threshold for collecting sales tax be pushed higher. eBay, for example, and you received one of these letters, Dustin, has argued that only businesses with at least $10 million in annual out-of-state tax sales or more than 50 employees should qualify for the sales tax. Amazon's actually in favor of the bill, which may sound odd, but there are two reasons for that. One, the company is big enough that collecting these sales taxes will be more of a burden to its smaller competitors. And secondly, Amazon's been moving to same-day shipping and setting up physical warehouses in just about every state. So increasingly, it's already required to collect sales tax under existing rules anyway. How do you feel about this bill?
It's interesting. I think currently in California, I already have to pay state tax on Amazon purchases. So it is something that's become a part of my normal online experience. But I definitely see the issue where it becomes a problem for the smaller organizations. Like I wonder what happens to places like Etsy or other like more indie online retail stores.
Mm-hmm.
And I really hope it doesn't drastically harm their business. And doesn't, you know, is making this a requirement giving more power to the monopolies? Is it creating more monopolies, in fact? I think it would be interesting to have this sort of threshold so it doesn't necessarily have to affect the small guys
right
at play. But, you know, I guess technically, according to the law, we should all be paying tax on online purchases anyway. So I don't know. I'm of two minds here. And as a selfish individual, I would rather it not affect the little guys. But yeah, you know, maybe it should. What do you think?
I think it's kind of sadly ironic that, you know, for years there had been the complaint that online shopping was shutting down mom and pop brick and mortar stores, and they couldn't compete with the people going online to places like Amazon. And for a while there, if you were an online mom and pop seller, you would have the advantage over owning a brick and mortar. And now with this new bill, it sounds like it's going to force a lot of mom and pop online sellers out of business. So it's basically just a continuous conglomerization of major big box online stores like Amazon and Walmart. It's going to make it easier for these big stores to compete against the smaller companies.
Yeah.
So it's kind of sad. So let's wrap it up here. Let's get you into a hot bowl of chicken soup or something.
Yeah, I need to get some rest.
Get you into some rest.
Heal up.
So but before we go, let me ask you, where can we find your work on the internet when you're not here on the show?
Well, you can find me on twitter.com/toast4321. Toast is in the bread. And you can also find my other random ramblings at ircwebcast.blogspot.com.
All right. And as for myself, you can find me at mrbabyman.com, facebook.com/mrbabyman, and twitter.com/mrbabyman. As for the show, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. You can subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com and our iTunes link is in the right-hand sidebar. We're also on Stitcher, so go to stitcher.com and do a search for Geeks of Doom, and you'll find our feed there. We're at facebook.com/thedrilldown, twitter.com/thedrilldown. If you've got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you've got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. You can let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.